Philip's original inspiration for the Marin Sangha was especially to find a way to deepen daily life practice and connect daily life practice with formal practice. And I want to continue in a way to explore aspects of that emphasis and relate it to my own explorations of the last month, where I was on retreat, as many of you know, for 4 weeks. I was at Spirit Rock. I've liked to do the March retreat, sometimes the February retreat, and have done at least a month on retreat in February, but usually March. Every year in the last 25 years, except for one. So it's been an important, that was when I was finishing my book, The Engaged Spiritual Life. And I think my deadline took precedence. But I was there for 4 weeks, and it was, very beautiful and inspiring. I touched, ways of being and qualities of awakeness that seemed deeper than before. And the retreat very much feels still with me. Towards the end of the retreat, I invited a sense of how to bring the 4 weeks of retreat into daily life. And I made some adjustments in my routine that strengthened practice. And so the energy of the retreat feels with me. Right now, and has, even though I came back about a week ago. And so I want to talk further about the retreat. I think I want to structure it in terms of what we can take from, in this case, my experience and bring into daily life. And I'm going to do it in terms of 10 ways to deepen daily life. And what I want to invite you to do is to see which of the 10, maybe one or two, touch you or inspire you that you might like to develop further, continue with in the next week. So I'll talk about retreat, but the emphasis will really be on listening for what calls, listening for, in a way, what can help deepen one's own practice, not in an overly ambitious way, but by having a sense of what's a skillful emphasis for this next period of time. And it may connect very much with what you're already doing. It might give further strength to that. So I'm going to invite you to listen. I'll mention a lot more things than are possible to implement. Just listen for one or two or maybe three. And I'm happy to be giving a talk. I often like to schedule a talk right after I come back from retreat, to kind of bring the energy of the retreat. So the first really way of connecting with our practice generally is to remember the importance of retreat. And I sometimes like to suggest a practice of knowing when one's next retreat is. Again, whatever the retreat means for you, it might mean a residential retreat. It might mean 2 days where you don't follow your ordinary routine, where you emphasize practice and awakening. Really, the crucial nature of retreat helps us get away from some of our habits. We have a lot of support. I think of retreats really as intensive training. So they're periods of intensive training, and they're, you know, they can be quite wonderful. There's a shadow quality, though, to a lot of retreats, including the way we do insight meditation retreats, which is that there can be, at times, a disconnection between the retreat and daily life, or the retreat has such wonderful support, and we don't take care of ordinary things. And then we go back, and all of a sudden we're consumed with activities. And the retreat, sometimes after we do a week-long retreat, after 3 days, we might say, I think I did a retreat. Has anyone had that experience, something like that? Yeah. And so I've actually, at times, on retreat, looked at emails and looked at the news so I wouldn't have a backup. And this was, you know, I started doing this after 35 or 40 years of retreat. So I'm not suggesting this at the beginning. But it actually helped a lot with integration with daily life, which is really where we're going. Retreats are helpful. There are training possibilities. But the real place is where we spend most of our lives. Like the great Tibetan teacher said, Shapkar Rinpoche, from the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, let your practice and life be one. That's what we're looking for. A second quality of the retreat, which really we can bring into daily life, is to find ways to keep remembering the core intention to be awake. How do we do that in daily life? What helps us to remember to be awake? One of the aspects of my experience that was inspiring was that there was a higher degree of continuity, including in my informal time, in meals, in walking, during much of the day, in which there was a quality of being awake. You know, in the informal time, I experienced as much as 90% of the time being aware, which really gave the flavor. And of course, it's, you know, often that amount or more in the formal meditation. It really gave a sense of the possibility of being awake all the time, which is the aim, you know, of really of being a Buddha, right? Being awake. This, and we've experienced that, I'm sure, maybe for shorter periods of time. But I had a, you know, so the question is, how do we remember? This is a more of a daily life implementation. How do we remember the core intention to be aware, to be awake? What helps us to do that? What helps us to remember? Unlike when I'm at my computer, I use a recording that I got from, I think, a meditation center, 45-minute recording that has a bell every 5 minutes. And at my computer, and this is a practice I've have done in the past, but sort of let go of. And I've done it more rigorously since returning. It just lets one stop and come back. The computer for me is the hardest, you know. But how do we, maybe this is a question for each of us, what helps me to be more present? You know, for some it could be connecting with the body, could be having an intention, could be putting a little poster on one's refrigerator. What helps one to remember to be awake? A third emphasis that I spoke about, I think it was, I don't remember exactly, I think it was here at Marin Sangha, but I also spoke at Spirit Rock about the importance of connecting mindfulness and awareness with metta and the heart qualities. And this was a big emphasis of my retreat. My default practice during the retreat was to have a large, spacious awareness infused with metta. And so when I would just be walking outside, there'd be this quality of what we call radiating metta, with the hills, with the turkeys, with the trees, and it was increasingly stable, this quality of being with the expanse in front of me. And I would do this in the dining hall as well. But the important thing is here, how to connect the kind heart with awareness, with mindfulness. You know, the talks I've given pointed to how there are ways that we separate those in the West. How do we bring those together? So that was a big emphasis, you know, and the practice of radiating metta, a very simple, accessible practice, is a way to implement that. One can do that, you know, at a meeting, on public transportation. And I love doing it just outside with the hills and in the dining hall with people. A fourth way to bring some of what I explored and learned in the retreat is to ask a question, which is a really crucial way of deepening daily life practice. What's my practice right now? You know, and so what's my way of cultivating awareness or kindness, mindfulness? Now, okay, I'm doing formal meditation, clear enough. Maybe I have a meal. Maybe I'm eating by myself and I want to bring awareness. What's my practice at the meal? What's my practice maybe taking a walk? This is a way really of remembering that core intention. You know, how do I remember to be awake moment to moment? So one way of doing that is ask, what's my practice now? You know, and this was especially good to ask on retreat because I could be, you know, just walking down to the dining hall and maybe I'd be a little bit lost in thought. And then I'd come back, what's my practice right now? And I could say, let's go to the radiating metta with the trees and the space. And that could be a way of answering that question. And we can ask that in daily life. Again, none of this is really designed to have us do too much. That's why I'm asking you to see what are the one or two things which resonate for you. I'm not really asking us to be other than where we are. But I'm mentioning some possibilities. And a fifth way of connecting this with daily life is to ask, what are my own personal next steps to help me remember? It might be that I want to bring awareness to an activity that I do every day that I haven't brought it to. Maybe I'll bring mindfulness to cleaning up after a meal, or cooking, or every time I take a walk. Is there something which is doable, not too much? Maybe you just bring it in 10 minutes, 20 minutes a day. This will make a difference. Be really, really crucial. You know, and I had, for example, I mentioned at the end of the retreat, I asked, how do I want to bring the retreat into my daily life? Do I want to make any adjustments? And one that I made was, if I'm having a meal by myself, I'm going to take it as a time of practice. In the past, I've sometimes done this, but if I'm having a meal by myself, I really like to, in the past, I've really enjoyed reading when I have a meal. Anyone else do that? Yeah. It has its enjoyable aspects. And I get more magazines and newspapers than I can read. So there's a backup. So why not? But actually, I've gone with that and really, it actually basically gives another significant period of time for practice, which makes a difference. The more little times of practice we do during the day, the more it weaves together this intention to awaken. You know, it's great to do one period, but if we can do, you know, maybe a meal and a, you know, 10 minutes another time, it starts weaving together the day and makes that deepening of daily life possible. And related to this is a sixth daily life implementation, which is to find times to stop or to pause, particularly if one's mind is busy. Just taking a vow, maybe, I'm going to, two or three times a day, I will stop for 5 minutes and just come back to being present. How many people do something like this already? Probably some of you. Yeah. It's a wonderful, simple practice. And I found myself also doing it on retreat. Sometimes if I would, my mind would get involved with something, just stop. And of course, I could do that on retreat without a pressure of getting something done, or without, to a large extent, the pressure of time. So how can we sometimes stop and pause? A seventh guideline that I want to mention is reflecting on the priorities in one's life. This happens to me virtually at every retreat. And we may have this occur at our own retreats, or sometimes when we, maybe even going on vacation, when we get away from the daily routine, we may ask questions. What's important for me? What do I want more of? What do I want less of? What's not happening that's important for me? And for me, the retreat is very much, the retreat was very much a chance to reflect in that way. And for me, it was especially of being less busy. So letting go of some things, you know, at least for a period of time. You know, so I've let go of some regular groups that I'm part of. And I want to prioritize, some of you know, I want to prioritize finishing my book, Transforming the Judgmental Mind. which I joke often that if I had done less inner work with my own judgmental mind, the book would have been done a long time ago. But there you go. And so I want to finish the book. And so I want to actually reserve time as much as possible, 4 or 5 mornings a week for at least 2 hours, 3 hours. What do I need to let go of to make that happen? Right. So that's what I'm looking at. When we have our counterparts, what's important for me that's not happening in the way I want? You know, reflection can help, but a retreat is wonderful for that because we get away from the routine. How can I be for myself less busy and really prioritize? For me, really 4 things, and particularly the first two: my own practice, completing the writing, and then also connections with people close to me, and engagement in the world to be of benefit. An 8th aspect of daily life, or the aspect of my retreat that we can connect with daily life. And this was the fact that during the retreat, one of the practices I did, you know, my default practice, my main practice, was having a large non-dual awareness and interfusing it with metta and hanging out there a lot of the retreat. But I also did about 2 hours a day a practice involving the development of the subtle energy of the body, something which is generally not present much in insight meditation, partly because the actual development of the model of the subtle body, at least in India, didn't happen until after the teachings of the Buddha came about. Probably about the 3rd or 4th century was only when the chakra system was developed in India. We have counterparts, of course, in other traditions. You know, well known would be the counterpart in Chinese tradition with the meridians and so forth, the basis for Chinese medicine and acupuncture and so forth. And I was doing a practice called Tummo, which is also known as the inner fire practice, which I've been doing about 6 years. It's a Tibetan practice. One of the great practitioners of Tummo was Milarepa, who is up on my wall in the woodblock right up here. I don't know how clearly you can see, but that's Milarepa. And Milarepa, it's supposedly in the cold Tibetan weather, Tummo keeps you warm also. But I practiced it primarily as an inner practice. And in the tradition, it's taken to be a very, very central practice, and it was very powerful. The effects that I experienced were more like it totally, when the body gets filled with the subtle energy, first of all, it's extremely blissful, but it also, the ordinary mind, the ordinary conceptual mind is just not there. It's gone when the body is filled with this blissful, fiery energy. And it gives one a sense of almost like the nature of things as being primarily a kind of subtle energy inside and outside. That's one of the effects of the practice. And I'm not so much recommending that particular practice, but just saying this can be something which we work on and develop. You know, maybe, people can do that sometimes through yoga or through qigong. That works in the same ways. You know, how many people have done that some through yoga or qigong? worked with that. And it can be a wonderful adjunct to meditation because it really, it can, you know, I often have found, because I, as some of you know, I also teach Qigong some, but that when people have a lot of very busy mind, I often recommend something like Qigong or a body practice involving the subtle energy, because it can really lead to a quieting of the mind in ways that meditation don't always do as directly. So it can be a very powerful kind of practice. The ninth practice that was really crucial for me is one that will be familiar to many of us here at Marin Sangha, our old favorite, non-doing. Remember that from our, we did a whole retreat on that here at Marin Sangha, and I gave a series of talks. You know, that quality of meditating and increasingly finding it possible to get out of the way so the meditation is happening without a meditator. Again, this is a more advanced way of practicing, but it's something that we can look at in meditation and daily life. How do I, particularly with something that I know very well, how do I leave out sort of the unnecessary, monitoring, controlling by the self, by the meditator, by the doer? And this was a crucial part of my retreats, letting the retreat, often inviting the retreat just to proceed, guided by my deeper wisdom. And some teachers I've worked with, they say, let primordial wisdom be the guide of the practice. Let your deep wisdom of an intuitive nature, when you're at a fairly deep place, let that be there and let go of some of the doing. And I mentioned how we sometimes experience this in activities that we're very familiar with, where there's a kind of a flow experience. Remember that, where we're in the flow, maybe again, something we know very well, and there's no thinking, there's no directing, we're just in it. It happens in creativity, in art, music, dance, meditation. And it's a beautiful quality to be developed. Again, a more of an advanced quality. Very much in the Taoist tradition. Lao Tzu said, this is from, 2300 years ago. One eventually reaches doing nothing. By doing nothing, everything is done. Instructions from one of the great Tibetan teachers, Longchenpa. Let your mind and body relax deeply in a carefree state with an easygoing attitude like a person who has nothing to do. And actually, in one of the Tibetan traditions, Mahamudra, the most advanced form of meditation is actually called non-meditation. You go from meditation to non-meditation as you go deeper. But it doesn't totally get rid of the need for a teacher, because we need teachers to teach non-meditation, right? Okay, let me go to the last one. Number 10. This is really to find ways to connect when one's lost. What helps one to come back? What helps you to come back when you're not aware, not present? How do you remember? What helps with that quality of continuity, returning, coming back? What helps with coming back when there's reactivity? When one's lost? A question to ask. There could be things that help. So I'll close now, and we can have some time for discussion with two quotations. One is from the Tibetan tradition. This is from a teacher named Tenshin Trungpa Rinpoche, a book called Crystal Clear. At the beginning, there is a distinct difference between the state of meditation and what happens after meditation. But as we develop, we need to merge these two states into one so that our practice becomes more and more continuous. This is a mingling and is considered to be of utmost importance. How do we mingle the meditation and what comes after the formal meditation? At first, your practice becomes grounded in good conditions or ideal conditions, but you must also learn to sustain it no matter where you are, no matter what happens. Not easy, but that's the direction as our practice matures. And then I'll give a version of that also from Sylvia Boorstein. This is from her book, Pay Attention for Goodness Sake. It's clear to me that my journey from confusion to clarity and from closed heart to open heart is one of continual arrivals and departures, a lifelong process that happens over and over again, every day. I'm fine with that. I love the story of the Buddha's enlightenment. The message of the story that arriving at freedom and happiness is a possibility. You know, for the Buddha, it was once and for all, right? Arriving at freedom and happiness is a possibility. This reminds me that I too can arrive, even if it is again and again, rather than once and for all. Arriving at that experience of clarity, in which I'm also happy. So let me finish there and invite us just to reflect on what might have been helpful. Possibly one or two of the 10 that you might like to, in your own way, implement, along with maybe any questions or reflections. So take a minute or two right now, and then we'll open up to our discussion. Let me invite any sharing, any questions, any going deeper into some of the areas. Patty, please.
Thank you, Donald. I always love when you come off a retreat. I want to recommend a website that I use for two of your suggestions. One is to take a break and throughout the day, and the other is to remember what's important. For about 10 years or more, I've been with a website called We Croak. And throughout the day, little sayings pop up from famous people and from teachers that remind us that we're mortal. And whenever it comes, whether it's convenient or not, I open that message and I read it and I reflect on it. And I remind myself that what's really important is remembering that everything is temporary and impermanent. My life is not going to go on forever. So that happens throughout the day with the app We Croak, and it helps me take time out to reflect, and it helps me remember what's important. And the other habit I have in the mornings when I wake up, the first thing I do is the five reflections. And also I send metta to myself and to everyone I'm going to interact with that day. So throughout the day, when I interact with someone that I sent metta to in the morning, I feel like I'm meeting an old friend, even if it's a stranger. I just feel like I'm in love with everybody I meet because I sent them loving kindness first thing in the morning. So thank you for those suggestions. I feel like I'm already integrating two or three of them.
Yeah. Thank you, Patty. Really beautiful and powerful, and you know, in hearing how you've implemented that in your own experiences is for me, and I imagine for many others, inspiring. You know, the Buddha thought of reflection on death as one of the ways to develop urgency in practice, right? And you know that. You know, making use of the technology to have a, I guess, a website, and you can have an app, We Croak, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's creative. And so, you know, for some that can be really, really helpful. And then I love your other practices as well. It's an ancient practice to, I think this is from Tibetan tradition. There's a practice called clarify consciousness at dawn, which more or less means when you wake up, go right to something clear, like you do with the five reflections when you wake up, right? Can we have a practice after we wake up? It can just take a minute in which we go to awareness, clarify consciousness at dawn, or clarify consciousness at the time of waking. You know, to do this. And I would say that any of the practices we're naming, what can be skillful is to have an intention to do them every day just for the next week. And I'll come back to that as we close. I don't suggest just having a general intention to do something, but rather combine that with a commitment to do it for a week, no matter what happens. Then, and when one does that, something like, let me take 2 minutes when I first wake up to come to awareness. You know, do that for the next week and it starts to become a routine. So, and then also very beautiful, that sense of bringing to mind those you'll be with and bringing metta. And these are beautiful practices, Patty. And not that time consuming, right? But it can really make a huge difference. Yeah, and finding, I like just to find ways to have metta be more and more there in different parts of one's life. It's a pretty accessible practice. Metta can really work well, you know, with groups or in the middle of activities. It doesn't require as much as some forms of meditation. You know, a secluded environment. Thanks, Patty. Yeah. Other sharing or questions, or could ask a question of Patty if you want to. Yeah, Liz, please.
Hi there. Every couple of years, I remember the Bodhisattva vow.
Yeah.
Which I learned when I lived in Pema Chodron's monastery in Nova Scotia. And I just made a sign, and I'm going to post it, and I've been saying a lot. The first line sounds a little arrogant, but I'll may I say it?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. So beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So the beings are numberless. I vow to save them. For me, is responding rather than reacting. It's how I'm going to save the beings are by my own growth, my own awakening, and my ability to do less harm.
Yeah, beautiful.
So it's very powerful for me.
Yeah, and the Bodhisattva vow for many people can be also, could be, doesn't take long, could be something one does, you know, upon waking or at the beginning of a meditation. And like you say, it is on the surface, we could say ambitious, right? No more ambitious, though, than the idea of awakening with the Buddha. Or, you know, with our metta practice, we aspire towards metta for all beings. And one way to hold that, that makes it not so much, you know, overly demanding ideal, is just to think that we're going in that direction. You know, we're not so much saying, I need to be here by this time, but I'm going in that direction. I'm intending to go in that direction. And I think if we've been practicing for some time, we can see how we've developed. The Dalai Lama said, when you look at your development over time, just ask how it is every 5 years. Not month by month, but ask how it is. And if we've been practicing for that length of time or more, can ask, how am I different than 5 years ago? Right? And we can see things. How many can relate to that? Can see movement, right? Yeah,
well,
so
I love it because it's fairly ancient, and
yeah,
the Bodhisattva vow, so it's very important to me.
Yeah, this is the Bodhisattva again is the being who's dedicated both to one's own awakening and also helping others to awaken, and has many, many manifestations. Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Liz. Time for one more. Yeah, please, Mary.
So, a couple of things that I do. I really like a sequence that Philip has been using, and it's the arriving sequence.
Yeah.
And I kind of drop in, and I first thing I do is I notice, like, where am I? I'm like, you know, I'm arriving here. And then, am I available? And if, am I available for this moment? And if I'm available for this moment, then the moment's available to me. And available, it means that I am kind of awake, but that not just awake, but that my heart's open.
Yeah.
And asking myself that a couple times during the day. And I, too, have two apps on my watch that remind me to do that throughout the day, is to kind of come to the here and now, and then ask myself that. And that's really helpful. The other thing that I've been doing too is I tend to be a very greedy type. And so I've been watching myself wanting, like here on the, you know, and just when wanting comes up, is I go to the meta phrase that I was in A Path with Heart. And that is, may I be filled with loving kindness. And then I say the rest. But it's like, if I am in this wanting mind, then what do I really want? And for me, if I can fill my being, and actually it's a very visceral felt sense of that, this loving kindness is kind of coming in through me, that at least momentarily it will give me myself some ease. And a practice I've been doing for the last few months is one, noticing the difference between a judging mind and a discerning mind.
Right.
And I know for me, the judging is very sticky. It feels there's a much more of a contraction, and the discerning is just open and trying to notice that felt sense between the two. And it's funny, I'll pick certain times where I'll watch judging mind. You know, reading the news, with out and about, at the store, and just those are good times to play with that. So that's three practices I've been doing lately. Oh,
wonderful. I love the sort of filling yourself with metta as an antidote to greed, and the difference between being judgmental and discerning. And you know, from my own teaching on that, you probably remember that we have to be a little careful, because in English we use the word judging to mean both judgmental and discerning. So we have to be clear with our definitions and the language, because it's we use the word judgment in English in an ambiguous way. But the core distinction between being judgmental and being discerning is crucial.
Yeah.
Thank you.